This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
I am Glenn the Geek from Lexington, Kentucky, and you're listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for July 20th, 2011, episode 232, sponsored by Pfizer Animal Health. Good morning, Horse World, and welcome to a special Best Of edition.
Let's think of this as a great big adventure.
Yeah.
An adventure.
Come on, it won't be that bad. It'll be an adventure.
Adventure is something we promise is gonna excite you. An adventure is something as thrilling as it can be.
I knew that I was born to ride. I was born to ride.
Howdy, everybody. Just me here today. As you know, we're off on vacation this week, so we're bringing you some special new episodes as well as some Best Of episodes. And today, we bring you a fun Best Of episode. We'll be back next Monday, 9 a.m. live after our vacation, and we appreciate you being with us here today. Today, we take a listen to some of the fun travel adventures that we've heard on the show. We'll take you to Africa, the Grand Canyon, the desert in the Middle East, and we climb Mount Kilimanjaro as well. Before we start our trek around the world, let's talk about our sponsor, Pfizer, and then the rest of the show will be commercial-free. At Pfizer Animal Health, they're passionate about the health and wellness of horses and all animals. Their expanded equine product portfolio includes their trusted Strongid C2X, West Nile Innovator, the Innovator family of vaccines, Solitude IGR, and Zylexis. Pfizer strives to make life better for horses and the people who care for them. Protect your horse against upper respiratory disease such as equine influenza virus and equine herpes virus strands 1 and 4. From the Fort Dodge vaccine line, Pfizer Animal Health offers Fluvax Innovator, adjuvanted with Metastem technology for improved immune response. For more information on Pfizer Animal Health's products, visit PfizerAnimalHealth.com. Now, the first stop on our great adventure today is with one of our favorite regular guests, one of the most traveled horse girls in the world, Darlee Newman from the PBS show Equitrekking. This is actually off of our third episode. That was all the way back on November the 3rd. We started November the 1st, this show, at the very, very beginning of the show. And she tells us about some of the behind the scenes of filming her PBS show Equitrekking. Our first guest today, I'm very excited about. She is an Emmy Award winning, a daytime Emmy Award winning TV girl, and she does a terrific job with the show Equitrekking on PBS and now all over the world. And of course, that is Darlee Newman. Are you there, Darlee?
I am here, and I was listening and thinking of stories when you were talking about careless.
Now, you have traveled all over the world. You probably, and that's what we're going to have you on about. We're having you come on with us once a month doing Behind the Scenes, a segment called Behind the Scenes, and that's what we're going to be talking about because you travel all over the world, and you and I had a phone conversation one day, and we were like, what could we do that's a little different? And you said, I could tell some of the stories that nobody has seen on the show. So,
yeah.
So that's what first, tell us. For those that don't know or don't get it or aren't familiar with it, tell us about Equitrekking. What is it? How'd you get started? That kind of thing.
Equitrekking is the travel TV show I host and produce. It's on PBS. And actually, Glenn, it's starting in Kentucky. The new season starts on Mondays at 7 p.m. starting this coming Monday. So,
yay.
Yeah, check your local listings because it's on in different times in different places. But we go all over the world and we horseback ride with local people. And, you know, we experience culture and history and we ride different breeds. So it's always a challenge for me because I'm always riding different horses. And it's, I don't know, that's been one of the most interesting parts of doing this because I just never, you never know what you're going to get. Like, and mm-hmm. I've had some awesome horses, I have to say. And usually they're good, but you just never know.
When you, every girl in the world, every, this is probably every horse person in the world, you have the dream job of every one of them.
Yeah. Well, it was, I thought mine was good.
No, this was my dream. I mean, I don't know. Like, it was a crazy idea. I was like, oh, wouldn't it be awesome if I could horseback ride around the world and travel and, you know, experience just so many different things. And, it, you know, it was a challenge to make it happen, but it's worked out so far. It's really caught on. People that aren't even into horses watch the show just because it's so beautiful.
And there's a little understatement. You won an Emmy last year. And you were nominated for one this year. You got to go down the red carpet with all the big celebs.
I know. It's crazy. Ooh. It's crazy. You
that
just never
got to
know
wear
this.
Your fancy dress and look all pretty. And you didn't look like a horse girl at all going down that red carpet.
Did everybody yell, who are you wearing? Who are you wearing?
Yeah. They were like, who are you? I was like, it's me. I'm on PBS.
Oh, my gosh. That's awesome. That is awesome. So what, Darlie, you've been all over the world, and you're going to continue to go all over the world. What exactly are you, you know, what's your favorite place that you've been?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, I have to say I love Ireland. That's definitely at the top of my list because there's so many great places to go. I love Castle.
Be honest. You love Ireland because you could drink from pub to pub to pub on the ride.
You know what, though? It's the characters. The people make the trip, and there's so many awesome people in Ireland. They're so warm and friendly, and the horses are chill. They're like laid-back horses there, too. I mean, you can get the spirited horse, but I just love the personalities there, and it's so beautiful. So how can you go wrong there? But the Ireland's at the top. I love Costa Rica. I love Hawaii. Jordan is fascinating. There's so many great places. You really, you know, can't go wrong by just putting your finger on, well, putting your finger on the globe and being like, let's go here.
So do you have, on the opposite side of that, do you have a least favorite place?
I've definitely had least favorite experiences and challenges. And it's not determined by the place. I think it just, you know how life is. It's just weird sometimes, and you never know what's going to happen. And definitely when we film our show and when we travel, it's, you know, there, you cannot really plan it. I mean, we have everything planned out so well, and then, you know, just something changes, and it's different. I got sick in Jordan. I loved Jordan, but I got sick when I was there.
Oh.
Something I ate, you know, and it was, being sick when you're traveling is just not fun. And when you're traveling and you're in the car.
Oh, no.
And you're like, where are the 7-Elevens? Where are the gas stations? There's like nothing here. Because you're driving. We like drove into the desert, and I was heading out to do this multi-day trek in the desert, and I'm just so sick. And I was like, are you serious? Now I'm going to go into the It's over 100 degrees. I'm going to go ride in the desert for 3 days. I think I'm going to die. But I thankfully got some medication and was okay. And I spent the day riding, but at the end of the day, and this is like, if you watch the episode, it looks beautiful because we're in this beautiful place. So the scenery must have taken my mind off it or something. But at the end of the day, I still didn't feel totally right. And we're in the middle of the desert and made this huge feast. They had buried a lamb in the ground and brought it out on a huge platter with, like, yogurt sauce and all this stuff. And I was thinking, can I just have some bread or crackers? Like, I don't want the yogurt-soaked lamb. I can't do it right.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, my gosh. Well, you have the most amazing stories.
Now, do you plan every little thing, or do you allow some room for improv in the shows? Do you know what I mean?
Oh, my God, there's so much improv, because we just, you know, when you get there, we have everything mapped out as far as the route we're going to take and how we're going to film it and where we're going to go. But when you get there, you kind of just throw it out the window because you have to take things as you go. So definitely things are not planned. And what we say and do is not planned because I just don't even know what we're going to see or discover that day. So it's really interesting. It's reality in that sense.
Wow. So tell us about, let's start. What's one of the stories that are the behind-the-scenes funny things that happens that we don't see on the show? Can you pick one for us this month?
Sure. I have a funny one that I would categorize into, like, an extreme adventure.
Okay.
Because I was thinking about it earlier, and I was like, well, we've eaten all these crazy things. We have, you know, these beautiful, serene rides, and then we have these crazy adventures. We have, you know, long days in the saddle. In Scotland, I would characterize a crazy adventure. I was riding with an endurance rider who competes, you know, all over, and she was serious. Like, she was serious. We were going to Loch Ness, and we had to meet our film crew in a different location. And so she was telling me, her name's Candy, and she was like, darling, so we're going to do a little bit of a longer ride, and we're going to go, you know, in through the forest and meet them at the lake because that's the way we have to get to Loch Ness. And I was like, okay, well, that sounds good. Oh, my gosh. We took off, and it was like trotting, cantering for, I think we were doing it for like 45 minutes. It wasn't just like, you know, nice trotting and cantering. We're heading through woods that haven't been trimmed. Like, the tree branches, I'm, like, ducking. Like, it was like an obstacle course. And Candy just keeps going, come on, let's go. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm getting my head taken off on this ride with this Scottish woman. But I survived. No, it was crazy, and I really wanted the film crew to be back there in the woods with me. And I was like, I really wish they could be experiencing this with me.
So, Darley, you're out there with, you know, some really amazing equestrians, you know, riders that have been all over the world that are, taking you through the woods. What is your background in riding to where that is, you're comfortable with that?
You know, I think it's just riding a lot. I've never competed. I've always done this for fun and pleasure. And though I do hunter jumper stuff here, and I train and try to jump and do that, you know, it's all for fun for me. So my background is, you know, I feel like I've really gotten to be a better rider and gotten the confidence by just riding so many different horses throughout my life, but especially on the show. And I'm sure that I'm a much better rider now, or at least prepared for those crazy things that happen. Or, you know, you just don't know. And the different styles, it's so fascinating to just go and get on a horse and maybe ride in a different way that you haven't tried before. So, no, honestly, I'm not a professional, and I'm not, you know, competing, and I'm not a world-class endurance rider. So when I go out with these people, I'm definitely challenged. But most of the time, they realize that, and they're like, oh, let me take it down a notch. But sometimes not.
Yeah, I was going to say it sounded like that lady didn't take it down a notch at all. So Yeah, exactly. So you would say the best way to just to become a better rider, from what I understand what you're saying, is that you just have to get on a bunch of different kind of horses and just try everything.
Well, I do think that's a good way to get better. I mean, I know a lot of people have their horse and they don't change it up as much. So I think when you do go somewhere else and you take a riding vacation or you go out with a friend on maybe their horse or something, I think that's a good way to just try something new and just get used to something different. And I do think that's a way to get better because you're challenged in a different way. What do you guys think?
I agree with you. I think the best way to learn to ride and the best way to train your horse is just, you know, put your butt in the saddle and ride. And I totally agree with you that doing it in different places and different everything is going to help you and your horse. So I do totally agree with you. And I'm absolutely so jealous of your job. Like, I thought this was a pretty awesome job. But talking to you, we need to be best friends.
See, she's going to be quitting already. She just started.
Oh, no.
What did you get, darling? Thank you, darling.
Yeah.
We appreciate you being on. I know you have to get to doing some editing for your show. Remind everybody where they can find out about the show and your travel agency, for that matter.
You can go to our website, equitrekking.com, and we've got, you know, video clips, information about the new season, travel articles. And then equitrekkingtravel.com is a place where you can find out about a lot of the trips that we've taken and liked, and they're places that you can book with us and go on your horseback riding vacation of your dreams. So lots of different options.
And that was Darlene Newman, our regular guest here on Horses in the Morning, and one of our good friends from the Equitrekking show over on PBS. We appreciate her joining us on a regular basis. Next up is one of our more adventurous guests that we've had on, and that is Kimberly Brown on her trip to Africa. We did this interview in two parts, her climb of Mount Kilimanjaro and then her Africa safari. We have both parts for you here today, and you will hear part one from episode 78 of Horses in the Morning and part two from episode 83 of Horses in the Morning back in February. In between the interviews with Kim, we have a little Templeton Thompson and her song, When I Get Where I'm Going. I thought that was appropriate for the adventure episode today. And then we have more coming for you after Kim, so stay tuned, and we hope you enjoy her adventure to climbing Mount Kilimanjaro and to Africa with all the wild animals.
Well, now it's time for our first guest, and I'm so excited. Jennifer and I went and had lunch with Kimberly Brown a little while back when she got back from her big adventure to Africa, and we were just rolling. She went for an hour and a half just telling us about the adventures there, and she was so entertaining. I called her up and I said, "You got to come on the Horses of the Morning show." And Kimberly is a horse person, and you know, we have said in the past that this show is about, you know, it's geared towards horse people, but we don't talk about horses all the time because horse people do other things. Well, this is a horse person that has done an incredible other thing, and it's Kimberly Brown from Horse Capital Productions. And hi, Kimberly, welcome to Horses in the Morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it is so nice of you to be here. Speak up a little bit. You're just a little bit quiet. But, you know, okay. It is so nice to have you here. It was so fun when Jennifer and I got together with lunch with you there a couple of weeks ago. So tell us what led up to this trip of a lifetime. Where did it start? How did it come to be? And then we'll talk about what you actually did.
That's a big question. I could go on for about an hour on that one. But the short answer is that I had always had an affinity for Africa based on always wanted to go on safari to see the big animals of Africa, and it had always been a lifelong goal of mine in the back of my mind. But it started when I was working late at night on the computer, and I somehow landed upon Africa, Tanzania, Kilimanjaro, and I said, you know what? I would really like to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. That is an extreme adventure. I definitely would need to work out for that, so I would help with some stress at work. And I started thinking about it, and late at night, my husband was sound asleep, and I woke him up, and I said, hey, guess what I want? And he goes, I don't know, you want to order a pizza? And I said, no, I want to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. And he said, yeah, sure, I'm in, whatever. Went back to sleep. Well, I had researched it in the middle of the night, done a little bit more work, and it had just stuck on my mind. And so by the next day, I was gung-ho, and I said, I've got to do this because it's extreme. It's going to get me in great shape. And I finally can make an excuse to go to Africa and go on a little safari at the end, which I'll tell you about as well. But it was absolutely...
Okay, Kimberly, hold on one second. I have to stop you.
Yes.
I surf late at night a lot, too, but never have I surfed and went, oh, I'm going to go hike to 20,000 feet in the middle of Africa. That's something I want to do when I'm surfing late at night. Have you ever done that, Jamie? Really wanted to hike a mountain in the middle of the night?
Oh, sure, all the time. Let's go. No, thank you.
It's sort of like watching the infomercials late at night, and then you buy that ice cream maker and never use it. But this time I actually committed, so I was stuck. But, you know, a little bit goes to that as well, that there have been so many people in my life that I've admired for being hardcore athletes. My parents were marathon runners, and family members were triathletes, and I had friends out in Colorado that were big into snowshoeing up the ski slopes before they went to work, and mountain biking up the mountains. And I had always been involved in sports, but on a technical level, so never a really strong sportsman from a physical standpoint. Riding, I was always very technical. I had great training, but really never crossed that line into being super physically fit and at that level of that athletic endurance. And I said, well, Kilimanjaro, one of the things that caught me on that was that slow and steady wins the race. And I've run my fair share of road races because those were the mandatory family events in our family. Every year we ran the Great Raleigh Road Race all through high school and college. And I thought, slow and steady wins the race. That's good for me. And so I had to train starting about a year out, and I did this really cool training program called P90X, and it's the only training program that I could fit into my schedule because I had limited time because of the big work project, and it was also something that had a lot of cross training, was going to do a lot of cardio, it was also going to do a lot of legs and strength training, and it worked out great. And as far as I know, I don't think anyone else has used that training program to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, so it was definitely an experiment, so I had my fingers crossed, and it worked out really well, and it just was the most amazing adventure ever. I went with two of our good friends, Faye and Jason from Lexington, Kentucky, my husband Evan, and then we met up with two seasoned mountaineers from the Midwest, and we went with our expedition group, which was called DeTasa, and I have to absolutely credit our success on the trip to our expedition guides, who were Justin, Buster, and Ari. They live in the Kilimanjaro region in near Arusha, Tanzania, and they absolutely made sure that we had everything we needed, the best guides available, and it was fantastic. So that's a little bit on how it fired.
Wow, that's something else. Now, you tell us about the hike. It was, according to what you've told us, it was 8 days, 60 miles to an altitude of almost 20,000 feet. I assume you were tenting and you were doing all those things that you do when you climb a mountain?
It was a little bit of everything. It was 8 days, 60 miles, and almost 20,000 feet. On Mount Kilimanjaro, we don't use supplemental oxygen, which now I'm thinking, boy, if I'd had a little canister of oxygen in my bag, that would have been really fantastic because I did suffer from altitude sickness the whole time, starting on day two. I'll tell everybody on international radio that on day two I got up and vomited in the woods from the altitude, and I had a horrendous headache and altitude sickness the entire time, but I was just on the borderline of still being safe enough to continue because our guides were really, really good at monitoring us medically to make sure that we didn't cross over the line into that danger zone. Because I've actually just learned recently from a Mount Everest documentary that more people have died trying to climb Mount Kilimanjaro than climbing Mount Everest. So that's a little shocking. But I have full faith in our expedition leaders because they really knew every footfall in every place to go on the mountain. And we went through five different climates. So we started off in the tropical rainforest. So we were, shorts and T-shirt type weather. And then and it rained. I mean, mudslides and everything else all around us. And we started off in the rain. Then we went through several moderate regions. It started to get very cold about night three. And then from there, we ended up in the Arctic region by the time that we got to the top of the mountain. And there was one night where I rolled over in my sleeping bag with all of my clothes on and hat and nearly goggles on and everything, and the thermometer on my backpack, which was right by me, said it was 10 degrees inside the tent. And so that was in the middle of the night where we sort of had good body heat keeping it warm. But 10 degrees is the reading that I took that was official, and that was about as cold as I could take.
Wow.
I have a question.
Yes.
How exactly does one pack for something like this? I mean, how do you pack for that? I'm just thinking, I had a hard time packing for a weekend of camping, much less climbing to the top of a mountain in 10-degree weather. That's ridiculous. So please, help me out.
Packing was a challenge. It's actually worse than going on a vacation where you're going to go, warm weather and cold weather, because then we had to have our technical gear in there too, and we had a weight limit of about 30 to 40 pounds for our bag, plus our day pack that we had that we carried on our small backpacks. So what we did with packing, we had a basically survival list of things we had to take, and I think the biggest baggie of things I had in my bag was actually medical supplies. We had all gone to a travel doctor in town, and we had all of our vaccinations, but in going to Africa, and especially in the very remote region up on Mount Kilimanjaro, where if you're going to get airlifted, you actually have to go to the neighboring country of Kenya, like Martina Navratilova, the famous tennis pro that had to be rescued actually just a few weeks after we completed our climb. So, you know, looking at things like Neosporin or Band-Aids and moleskin and different types of antibiotics for different types of critters, bugs, and everything else that comes to mind was really, you know, the biggest thing that I had. But everything was in layers. By day three, the layers didn't change very much. They just got heavier on top. And it was very strategic because we did have the weight limit. So we had the packing list, we had the technical supplies, medical supplies, and then the weight limit ultimately was the tough part because I always grew up hearing that when you're going to pack for a trip, you pack everything you want, you take out half, then you really only carry what you can take with you and run with for a half mile. So in this case, I was thinking, oh, gosh, what can I carry up this mountain for 8 days? And fortunately, we did have porters that helped us with some of our long-term gear, which was fantastic. But packing was a challenge.
Okay, so what'd you eat? What'd you eat? What, I mean, how did the food, how'd you do food and water?
Okay, the food was absolutely exceeded my expectations, and that was one of the great things by choosing carefully the expedition company that we went with, which was Daitasa, Destination Tanzania Safaris. And when I went and did my research in the middle of the night, and then following, you know, subsequently in the next few days and contacting people that had been to Mount Kilimanjaro, one of the big success or failure factors was how well do people eat and do they stay healthy on the mountain? Because it's not just what do you eat, but how much you eat, and is the food going to make you sick? So what we had was really a combination of African-American food, and I had the best fried fish on the mountain I've ever had in all of my life. It was out of this world. I have no idea what the batter ingredients were, but it was really, really tasteful. So we had a combination of a lot of potatoes, tons and tons of eggs the first few days. So we loaded up on protein because that was the most perishable item that we had as we carried. And then heavier. And then as we got farther up the mountain, it switched more into fresh fruits and vegetables. Still, we had the potatoes and the starches to fuel our body. And then by the last few days, what we had a lot of supplemental with power bars that we all packed. And the power bars really saved the day because we were burning so many calories during the day. Because every day we hiked anywhere from, you know, 5 to 7 hours. And when I say hiked, not really walking along on a walking trail, but climbing uphill, rock climbing on many occasions. We never had ropes to fix us into the mountain. It was just about that steep where you need the belay system, but on that Kilimanjaro, it's all free climbing. So we ate as much as we could, but the higher altitudes that people go, what happens is the body starts to shut down and stop digesting food as the heart rate starts to go up. So by day 5 and 6 and 7, what was starting to happen is the appetite is there, but then as soon as, you know, I try to eat, it'd be impossible to eat because it's like trying to eat after you've run a sprint or ridden a jumper course and you're out of breath and really what you want is a drink of water, but your body needs the food. So it became harder and harder to eat, but fortunately the meals and the food that we had were really, really fantastic, and I highly recommend lots of energy bars for people that are going on adventures like that. And I actually keep energy bars. I kept them in my horse trailer. I keep them in my car now, everywhere I go, just in case I need a snack. So,
you know, it must have been especially tough for you because you had the altitude sickness, too. So the eating must have been especially...
I did. There's a wonderful little product called Diamox, which is a medication that I had just heard about on this trip. And I'm not a big proponent of taking medications and pills and tablets. I hardly ever take an aspirin. On this trip, I actually ended up going through about a whole bottle of ibuprofen, actually. So thank you to our climbing buddy, Michael, for bringing the giant bottle of ibuprofen. But oh, absolutely. But the Diamox helped a little bit with the nausea, but it was hard because I was nauseous. I had the headaches. And I also, just before I had left, I had come down with the flu. I mean, violent flu a week before our trip. And I was so determined not to miss the trip because I had people counting on me that were team members. We planned it for a year. I trained for a year. So I went anyway. So it probably serves me right that I got the altitude sickness and everything that came along with it because I probably should have been a slight bit smarter and rescheduled the trip because my body wasn't at peak fitness because of being, you know, taken down with the flu. But I made it nonetheless. But getting back to the water, yes?
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead about the water.
Water, you know, most of us here, you drink your 8 glasses of water a day. On the mountain, we needed 3 to 4 liters of water per day. That is so much water. And think about if you've got 2 liters in the grocery store, 2 of those, and you're carrying in your arms. That's how much water we had to go through each day, which also meant that we had to go to the bathroom all the time.
And you're wearing, like, 40 layers of clothes.
Yes. I mean, they are tucked in layers and layer upon layer upon layer. And then the really fun thing out there is that there aren't any bathroom facilities. So that's actually the question that I get most after, how in the world did you come up with this crazy adventure, is, where'd you go to the bathroom?
So, that was mine, too. I was going to ask.
So here it is.
We're horse chicks.
Radio.
We're horse people, Glenn. We just squat. I mean, that's all we do. We have to.
Well, you know, it's one thing when you've got the privacy of a stall. It's another thing when you're out in the middle of hundreds of thousands of acres of vastness with a group of team members and some leaders that are all staring at you. So, you know, during the day when we were in between campsites, we had to get very familiar with Mother Nature behind a rock or a small bush. And then actually, fortunately, at campsite, we had this little green tent that came with us. It was like this little tiny porta potty, but it was a green tent that blew violently in the wind, and it had this little bucket with a seat on it. And, you know, I had this big fear that I was going to be the person that was going to be trapped in this little green potty tent when the wind would come by and blow the top off, but fortunately, that never happened. So that was my big fear. And, you know, the hardest part about that, you mentioned the layers, is that as the altitude got higher, what happens is the heart rate, the resting heart rate, gets faster. So where my resting heart rate before the adventure at sea level was in the mid-60s, I started monitoring my resting heart rate. And by day 3, it was up to about 85 beats a minute resting, meaning just doing nothing. So 85 beats a minute, that's like you've been running up and down your stairs in your house for a few minutes, and you're slightly winded. Well, it got up to 112 beats a minute resting heart rate by day 5. And at 112 beats a minute, that's essentially like you've been doing aerobics for an hour at a really low-impact aerobic rate, but try having to then throw a sprint in after that. So in the middle of the night, or any time of the day, but especially texting in the middle of the night, was, okay, now I've got to get up and go to the bathroom. And fortunately, you know, I didn't have to go that far from the tent. I always ended up coming back to the wrong tent. So sorry, guys, all my teammates. I think I went in everybody's tent but mine at least once or twice. I don't know how that happened, but, you know, I'm going to credit that to a little bit of the altitude as well, because the cognitive ability starts to diminish. So even though our tent had a big number 10 right on it, there were, you know, 4 tents for our team members. The guys had a tent. You know, each of our, you know, Faye and Jason had a tent, Evan and I had a tent, and then the guys had a tent. And then there was a, you know, another big common tent. But there were only 4 tents that looked alike, and mine had a number 10 on it, and I still went to the wrong tent. And I'd hear in the middle of the night, wrong tent, Kimberly, next one. But, you know, I think I was just so traumatized by the, you know, having to get up to go to the bathroom when it was 10 degrees and I had to walk out of the tent and my heart rate would surge, and then I'm in this little green flapping tent trying to, you know, undress appropriately in this wild weather and then get back to the tent and then back in the sleeping bag. And I had no idea that it could be so hard to get into a sleeping bag. I mean, there were days where just, you know, rolling over at night, I would think, oh my gosh, I've just rolled over in my tent and my sleeping bag, and my heart is racing, and I've got to climb another 2,000 feet straight uphill tomorrow. Oh my gosh. So it really was, everything about it was being very close to nature, very close to death, I thought, at some point. And
you're really talking us into this.
Yeah. Pardon? Yeah, this sounds like a lot of fun, and I'm super excited about doing that because you're selling it, really. Go ahead.
They won't be hiring her from the Tourist Bureau of Kilimanjaro.
No. Well, you know, the scary parts are the best parts to tell. You know, if I told the story, if you ask, somebody that's pretty laissez-faire about it, they'll be like, yeah, it was a great trip. It was 8 days. We made it to the top. We took the picture. Yay. But, you know, the harrowing parts are the most fun parts to tell, and that's, you know, what I remember almost the most, but one of the best parts, and actually something that I wish I had more time to go back and think about and do it again, would be the panoramic views, because everywhere we went, you know, for that entire 8 days, with the exception of, I think, the last 2 days, so the first 6 days, we really didn't see any other people, any other signs of life, no helicopters, airplanes, no technology, no radios. It was all very natural, one with the earth, and I, you know, we'd wake up in the morning and we'd start off on our trek. And one day we had a long plateau. It was all day on the Shura Plateau. And we could see for, I don't know how many miles, 20, you know, looked like 20 miles we had to go that day, but it was probably more like 8 or 9 we hiked that day. But as far as we could see into the distance and just looking left and looking right, and it was just phenomenal to see how much land there was out there. And the colors were vibrant, and it was beautiful. We had a little bit of rain the first few days, but it was pretty cloudy most of the time, which our guides tell us is not a bad thing, because what turns people around on the trip when they psych out or conk out on it is the first few days when it's raining really hard, some people go, you know what, forget it. I have been completely drenched. I'm tired. I want to go back. And the other part is when they can see the peak of Mount Kilimanjaro the whole time, and it is so tall and so vast, that when people get the first glimpse, sometimes they go, you know what, forget it, I'm out of here. And so for our group, it was hazy and foggy a lot of times, and we were actually had a pretty solid cloud cover. So for most of the trek, we could only see up to the cloud cover of Mount Kilimanjaro, and it wasn't until day 5 or 6 that we got above the clouds and we could really see the peak. So, you know, good and bad for not being able to see the peak the whole time, but the views every day and everywhere we went were extraordinary. And I've got a ton of pictures posted on Flickr, and you can get to that via my website, which is KimberlyBrown.com, if you want to go check out the pictures. And I've also got safari pictures, which were just phenomenal.
Oh, so you did see some animals out there, just maybe not on the top of the mountain.
Not on the top of the mountain, but actually on day 1, 2, and 3, we saw elephant tracks. We saw Cape buffalo dung on the side of the path. And, you know, we're all excited. Wow, there's, you know, Cape buffalo poop on the trail. This is great. And, of course, you know, I want to see the animals. And our guide says, no, no, no. We don't want to come across Cape buffalo or elephants on this trek because they're very aggressive and territorial and they could just stampede us. But, you know, we're walking along, you know, the path, and we might see some results that they've been here recently. And, you know, one day we were walking along the path, and walking along the path, meaning, you know, hiking, and we're huffing and puffing, but I say walking along the path. And, you know, I'm thinking, gosh, this path is pretty well worn. You know, I thought this was a more remote route than usual. And our guide, Buster, I think he told us that was the path that, it was the animal path. So not the path that was made by all the many of hikers that had come this way, but following the animal path, which made sense.
Oh, wow.
But also they were keeping a keen eye out for what we would see. And then on day, I think it was 4 or 5, we actually were at a really high altitude there and came across a set of large animal bones. And it was really astonishing to see that. And there's a really cool picture on my website of me, you know, standing beside the animal bones. And, you know, my first thought was, what in the world were these big animals doing at this altitude? But apparently the elephants would come up to the higher altitude on Mount Kilimanjaro for the salt licks that were in that area. So the pregnant elephants needed that extra mineral during that time that they were pregnant, and so part of their migration a long time ago is they would go up there, get those extra minerals, and then migrate away. So we only saw one large set of skeletons, lots of little animal skeletons down at the lower altitude. But once we got up 15,000 feet, it was just like Mars. It was
I would imagine. I mean, what can survive up there? I mean, is there, when you get to that level, are there any plants? Or are you just, I mean, are you hiking through deep snow? What's the landscape look like to you right there in front of your face?
Well, at about that altitude, when it started crossing over, you know, 10,000 feet, getting into 15,000 feet, the tallest mountains in Colorado, you know, most people are seeing at about 10,000 to 12,000 feet. Some of the peaks go up to 14,000 feet. So on Mount Kilimanjaro, when we're at that 15,000 feet and above level, the plants get shorter. They are scrubby. And then as we got up to probably that 15,000 feet level, it really looked like, you know, in some cases, moon landscape. So pictures that I've seen from the moon where it looks like this loose, scree, fine, powdery dust with some big rocks tossed in a couple of places, that's what it looked like on the areas that were the plateaus. And Mount Kilimanjaro is an old volcano, and so it's formed where it has, you know, very steep walls and then a plateau, steep walls and a plateau. So really there was, at that height, not that much to look at as far as greenery goes, animals and plants and wildlife. And fortunately, we didn't see any snakes, and I am so thankful because Tanzania has the most deadly snakes in all of the world. So I was terrified that a, you know, black mama would just climb in my sleeping bag with me. But we were very fortunate. And at those altitudes, there aren't mosquitoes, there are no snakes, no wildlife to be afraid of, no birds, which is weird, right? We had birds at some of the lower
altitudes.
No air. And also... And a lot less bushes to hide behind, I would say.
The bushes got smaller and the rocks got more sparse. That was definitely a challenge. Now, on day 6, which was the day that we climbed the most dangerous stretch of Mount Kilimanjaro, that was actually called the Western Breach Approach. It's this western wall. We had to stay ahead of where the sun was shining over the mountain, and we had to start at 5 o'clock in the morning to stay ahead of where the sun was going to land, because on that area it was very, very steep. It was about 6 to 7 hours of steep rock climbing on our hands and knees and, you know, pulling ourselves up with our arms all day long. And in that area, it was known for tremendous rock slides. So there were big boulders the size of Volkswagen bugs that were anchored in on that side of the mountain, and then a lot of loose scree, that really powdery rock debris. And at night, it all freezes solid. Well, as soon as the sun hits it, it gets loose and just slides down, like trying to walk up a giant sand mound. And so on that day, that was probably the most challenging day for sure, because the altitude was even higher, the air was thinner, and the footing was not very good. Fortunately, we had our great guides that led us step by step along the path, and we traversed back and forth across the mountain on that area until we got to the safe spot. We got to the spot where then it didn't matter if the sun was shining on us, and we had a quick break. And at that break, we turned around and we looked, and the clouds were completely below us. We could see Mount Meru way in the distance, which was just a little dot. And at that point, we were really way above where airplanes fly, and that was a really astonishing moment that we had gotten to that point. And on our trip, climbing the Western Breach and getting to the top of that, I think, was as monumental for me as it was to reach the top, because that was definitely the day that about every 15 minutes I literally thought I was going to die. I thought that they could just leave me behind, forget about me. I'd be dead in a couple of minutes, and that would just be so much easier than chugging ahead, because I hit the wall about 30 minutes into that day, and we still had about 6.5 hours to go. So that was definitely very challenging on that day, and mostly beautiful panoramic views, but not so much scenery and animals. We had to wait till the safari to get to the animals, and I did come nose to nose.
And Kimberly, we're gonna have to. We run out of time, so will you do us a favor? Will you do us a favor and come back maybe one day next week and talk about the safari? We'll do a part two.
Hard times.
Us today, continuing a two-part series that we started last Wednesday show. If you didn't hear it, go back. It was the 16th. Look for the show on the 16th. And it's a two-part series because we just plain ran out of time talking to her. We were having so much fun. We had Kimberly Brown on, who talked about her hike of and climb of Mount Kilimanjaro, and that was so fascinating. And then the second part of her trip to Africa and Tanzania was a safari where she got to meet some animals that were slightly more wild than some of the ones Jamie's looked at recently in her horse searching. and she got to meet them up close and personal, and that, of course, is Kimberly Brown. Welcome back, Kimberly.
Thank you, thank you. It's always good to be on the show. And this time I promise that the Tourism Bureau in Africa is going to be very pleased with my account of the adventure.
Yeah, because they're about ready to wish you were never coming back after that talk about Mount Kilimanjaro and you throwing up every day and all that stuff.
I do recommend climbing Mount Kilimanjaro, but it is not for the faint of heart for sure, but there's no training necessary to go on safari.
That's true, yeah.
Thank God.
So did you do safari before or after Kilimanjaro?
I did safari after the Kilimanjaro, and that was definitely the way to go because after climbing the mountain for 8 days, my legs were like jello, and I was really, really thankful just to sit down in the rover and go on hunt with our cameras for the big animals in Africa. And it completely exceeded my expectations because I thought that we were just going to be sitting and riding in the rover the whole time, and then every now and then we'd go, hey, get your binoculars and let's see from afar that little spot over there, that's a lion, and see that head bobbing, that's a giraffe. But actually, it was really engaging, and there were times when I was looking to the left and there was an animal behind me, and then somebody from our group, there were four of us, would say, oh, look in front, and oh, look behind. So it was really a lot more intense than I thought, and fortunately, instead of having to hike all of those miles through the area where we did the safari adventure, we got the rover and the guide to take us. So that was super relief from the 8 days on Kilimanjaro.
I know you have some stories about some of the animals, and we're going to post some pictures in our show notes page as well. But Jennifer and I were talking after you were on the show last week, and we kind of ended the show, and we had a question. Once you climbed the mountain, how'd you get back down?
You know, sadly, there's some helicopter that picks you up at the top. You know, I think that's why people go helicopter skiing. It, you know, you don't have to climb to the top. They just fly to the top and drop you off, and you ski down. Well, in this scenario, we had to climb all the way up, and then we had to climb down. And we climb up the long way so that our bodies can acclimate to the high altitude, and then we go down the direct steep route. So we climbed up about 45 miles and straight down about 15 miles.
Oh, boy, you know, you get to the top, and then you got to, then you have to think about getting back. I mean,
that's very true, and that's actually, you know, a lot of people that you know, talk about Mount Everest because that's probably the most documented mountain climb out there as far as, you know, publicly accessible television shows. They talk about you get to the top, and then you're only halfway. So part of what really psychs people out is in climbing and getting to the summit of a big mountain, not just Kilimanjaro, but Everest and K2 and all the other big mountains, is that you've got to be able to have that mental capacity to say, I've got to make it to the top, and that's only halfway because I have to be healthy and sound and safe to make it all the way down. So the going down part, I would say, is probably harder on the body than going up, but going up is definitely more dangerous as far as being at risk for altitude sickness and not sure if you're going to make it, because it's definitely a mental challenge for sure. And going down, it's, well, you know, what goes up must come down. I'm getting down one way or another, but it's going to be a little hard on the knees and hard to train for going down the mountain for sure. But that's a good question.
Well, and I just blew your commitment to the country of Tanzania, its tourist bureau, because we just pretty much talked it out of it again. So.
Well, it's all about being prepared and all about choosing a great expedition company, which we did, because the whole way I felt very confident that, you know, even if I had a little bit of altitude sickness, I could look to our head guide and say, am I okay to keep climbing or not? And they made it very clear that if the guide said, you have to turn around now, even if your mind says, I want to keep coming, if the guy, you know, going up the mountain, if the guide says, you have to turn around, that's it, game over. So on day two, I woke up thinking, oh, gosh, I hope he doesn't tell me I have to turn around, this is going to suck. But I was still, you know, within that healthy zone, even though I was uncomfortable. And so I was allowed to keep climbing, and I was able to make it physically and mentally, and it was very successful. And that's why we relied on really experienced guides, kind of like we rely on really experienced horse trainers. So,
well, now, so now we're on the safari. You had told us some stories when we got together a couple weeks ago about the safari. So share those. What were the highlights, and how up close and personal did you get with animals that wanted to eat you?
I got so close that it made my heart beat pretty fast, I would say. And one of the big surprises is that we also got to see the Maasai warrior village. And if you're familiar with any of the National Geographic or specials on Africa, the great warriors of that continent, the Maasai warriors have spanned over several countries in Africa, and they're the blood-drinking, lion-killing tribe in Africa. And when our guide told us that our first day of safari, I know, we were going to go to a Maasai village, asked if we wanted to go, and I said, absolutely, this is fantastic. I love experiencing culture. We got there, and then the guide said, okay, go on in. And so the four of us, it was my husband and I and our two friends here from Lexington, we went into the Maasai village. We were greeted by the chief's son, and he was very friendly, spoke a little bit of English, and my first thought was, gosh, I thought he'd be taller, because the Maasai warriors, we think of them as being, you know, 6.5, 7 feet tall, but he wasn't that tall. But the village had the big circular spears that were carved on the top with big points to keep out the wild animals, because they really were in the middle of the safari region where, you know, giraffes were wandering by and lions were stalking the village. We couldn't see them, but they were out there. And we got in the village, and they put these headdresses on us and did this welcome dance. And at that point, I thought, gosh, I know these guys drink blood. Are they cannibals? I sure hope not. I hope I'm not like in that Pirates of the Caribbean movie where he's welcomed like a king and then they want to eat him. So it wasn't like that at all.
I got to tell you,
the Maasai tribe, I'm trying to remember the name of the show on National Geographic. It's Ollie and there's another guy, and they go to live with the Maasai tribe. And
oh, wow.
I almost wonder if that kind of helped them out, helped you out a little bit, because now they're kind of more familiar with, you know, white people. It's
right.
It's an amazing show, and they basically lived with the Maasai tribe, and they had to become and do the things that the Maasai did, including, you know, drinking blood and eating monkeys or whatever they were eating. I can't even remember. So when you went there, and again, the Maasai are very dangerous people, were you nervous at all?
I was a little nervous when the guide did not go in with us. And at that
yeah,
point,
that would be a clue.
Yeah,
they're going on.
I'm like, I was thinking, Ayubu, what's going on? He's staying behind, because they did this welcome dance, put the headdress on us, and took us in, and we were surrounded, and they have about 100 people that lived in the village that we were in, and I didn't know what I was supposed to do, because they separated us apart. They said, we need to separate each other now. I'm like, separate? This is not good. But my friend Faye and I went in one direction, and our husbands went in the other, and our husbands did the jumping competition where they stand with the spears and they see how high they can jump. And then we went to the other side with the women where they did this dance and chant, and we were supposed to bounce around a little bit, and I wasn't exactly sure what we were saluting or dancing to, but it was great fun. And then we did go into one of their huts, which was a dung hut made of cow dung. And that's where they live. It's about a 10-foot diameter structure with a little fire pit in the middle. And they really live like that. So I have a great appreciation of the more primitive cultural lifestyle, because the 100 people in that tribe, with the exception of the chief and family, lived in that village area. And the chief lived up on the hill, and we couldn't see his hut, but I'm sure it was probably substantially bigger.
Now,
oh, my gosh.
If I remember right, the Maasai women are the ones that wear those collars, too, the white, bigger collars. Yeah.
Yes, they put the collar on me, and I didn't know what the collar signified. I wasn't sure what I was supposed to do with it, but the beadwork was beautiful. And it's a little bit like visiting maybe an Amish community here in the United States, where they preserve their culture, but now they recognize that they do need to be open to some of the outside, you know, more westernized civilization, so that they can share their culture and vice versa. And so the Maasai warriors, their children do go to school in the mainstream school system, but they still live in their modern ways. And so when you're out in town in different parts of Tanzania, in, you know, Arusha was the major city, we could see some of the people dressed in the traditional bright red or bright purple wrap of the Maasai. And so that's how they're identified. They'll be out in the mainstream culture working other jobs, perhaps, but they still stay very true to their cultural dress, which is very beautiful
okay.
and striking and intimidating a little bit.
Now, are the Maasai the guys that wear gourds?
No, they had the full, it's almost like a giant bath wrap that's a beautiful red tapestry, but it resembled mostly the fabrics that I would see probably in Scotland. A lot of plaid, and I was very surprised, and I thought the plaid came from Scotland. So now I'm not sure, but the Maasai wore purple plaid and red plaid, and that was their traditional dress that they've worn for many, many, many years, and it's a giant wrap that goes down to about mid-shin.
I had to ask. Okay, I just had to ask.
I have to get us back to animals now, because we're a horse show. So tell us about, so continue your adventure.
So people, culture, and animals, absolutely. So that was our first meet and greet on the safari, was actually meeting the Maasai warriors. And then from there, we went to the Ngorongoro Crater, and that's actually where the Maasai lived in that area. And they're the only people that lived in that wildlife conservation area. No fences or designated areas where they say the animals have to stay. The animals just go, because the crater is lush with wildlife. It's lush with food and water and everything else. So the most surprising thing that I saw there was that all of the animals were really fat. And it was comforting for me to see that, because I knew we were coming at the very end of a dry season, and I thought, oh, gosh, we're going to see these really emaciated animals, and, oh, it might be sad. I was trying to prep myself for that. But all the animals were fat, and we saw, first of all, in the Ngorongoro Crater, cheetahs, a pair of cheetahs, and apparently that's extremely rare. It was about 10 after 6 in the morning. We were the first safari vehicle in that conservation area because our guide was super aggressive about making sure we were number one to see what was happening at sunrise. And I have a big picture of a cheetah taking a giant yawn in the morning, and then they were playing around a little bit. And I thought, oh, great, I've seen the big cats. This is it. And then we went on a little bit, and we saw zebras, which I just was completely astounded by. There were hundreds and hundreds of zebra everywhere we looked, but they were a little skittish, so it was hard to take a photo of a zebra. And they were tiny. I was surprised by how tiny the zebras were. And then still pretty early in the morning, and our guide, our driver, gets on the radio, and he's speaking in Swahili. And I hear a bunch of Swahili, and I hear Simba, Swahili, 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 Simba, which is the Swahili word for lion. And I went, oh, that's a lion. Yay, this is exciting. And I said, what's happening? And he goes, we have a lion sighting. It's a morning kill. And I made a rule that I didn't want to see any animals taken down. That just wasn't going to happen because as an animal lover, I can't take that. But there was an animal already that had been hunted down, and there was a lion sighting. And there was another vehicle behind us, and our safari guide said, hold on. And I'm standing up looking out of the top of the sunroof area. And he takes off down the path like a car chase in a movie, and he runs this other safari vehicle just about off the road because we're jockeying for position to see who's going to be first on the trail. And we get there first, and we arrive to see the biggest, fattest lion I've ever seen in pictures or even imagined, about 100 yards away. And he had the big pot belly, and he was standing there still, looking left and looking right, and just looking around and licking his lips and taking a big yawn. And then on the other side of us, this is where we look left, look right, there was a pack of hyena, and the hyena were watching us, watching the lion, because when the lion is done feeding, then the hyena gets to move in. And then after the hyenas are done, then the jackals move in. And so it was really amazing to watch that circle of life come through and the hierarchy and the food chain on how everybody survived with that one giant kill. And it was in the little bit of the marshland, and we couldn't tell what it was. And, of course, my curiosity got to me. I said, I know I didn't want to see any dead animals, but I've got to know what the takedown was for today. What was the prize this morning? And actually about that time, a ranger vehicle showed up, and the rangers jump out with these big rifles, and I thought, oh my gosh, they're going to be eaten by a lion right in front of us. What are they doing? And it turns out that the ranger station had been monitoring what was happening in that area, and they thought that the lion had killed a black rhino, which is a very endangered species. I think a few years ago there were only 10 or 15 left in the world, and they were in that area. Well, it turns out it was not a black rhino. The lion, actually the lionesses, had killed a Cape buffalo, which is an enormous beast. And that's why there was so much feeding activity and so many different animals that were really getting a fill, and everybody was walking out with a full belly. So it was an endangered animal. It was one of the very plentiful but sad day for the water buffalo. And that's how we started off our safari that morning. And I thought, oh my gosh, it just can't get better from here. And then we had our breakfast at the hippopotamus pool. And at the hippopotamus pool, we've been conditioned so much that you don't get out when you see hippos. You just watch them from afar because they're very territorial. And of course, the guide says more people get injured or killed by hippopotamus than anything else. They just bite you in half and spit you out, but they won't eat you. I'm like, well, that doesn't help.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's comforting.
So we had a very, very good respect for the animals, because Faye, at one point, she's in trouble now, jumped out of the rover vehicle to take a picture of a giraffe, and a ranger had driven by and, you know, was shaking his hand and yelling at her, and thought, oh, Faye, you better get back in the car right now. And she goes, well, I won't do that again. So they're really serious about keeping the visitors safe. But we get out at the hippo pond. Our Yubu, our guide, says, okay, we get out now, and when we have breakfast. I said, well, I'm not getting out. You get out.
You're the one that sent us into the into the man-eating village over there.
Exactly. I'm like, wait a minute. I think I've learned my lesson. I'm going to stay in the Range Rover right now, and I'm just going to eat my breakfast in my lap. And he's like, no. It's safe. The hippos, and there were probably 20 of them, they're sleepy, and the water is cold, and all they'll do is just make a lot of noise, and you just move very slowly and whisper. I said, okay, well, this is fun. So I get out, and we actually get some pictures, and then a yibu starts talking to the hippos and making some grunting, squawking noises, and they start talking back. And it was the most amazing thing I have ever seen in my life. And we're looking at the hippos, and then, of course, our guide, who's very keen with his eyes and surroundings, says, oh, well, there's a hyena behind us stalking us, but pay no attention to the hyena. I'll watch him. You keep watching the hippos. We'll see more hyenas later. And I went, oh, my gosh, I'm getting back in the car. Well, he brings out our little box breakfast, and we pull out our breakfast on the hood of the car, and we're eating breakfast. And our friend Jason is getting ready to take a bite of this wonderful banana muffin bread, and he goes to take a bite, and a bird swoops down, pulls it out of his hand, and flies off. But this is like fantastic. Park out here. This is crazy. But it was amazing. And, I knew I was safe as long as I did what the guide said, but it was really special to be out there with all the animals and know that if we're looking in one direction, we could have a hyena behind us. And then later, while we were having breakfast, we could see the one elephant that was walking over to the water to drink. And I thought, gosh, this is just breakfast, and I feel like I've already had the experience of a lifetime. And so from there, we drive on, and we saw during that day, we actually were on safari 2 days, probably about an hour and a half of actually seeing animals. And that's more than most people see when they go on a 2-week safari.
That was a lot of animals.
20 or 30 different animals. And we saw warthogs. We saw baboons up close. We saw zebra everywhere. We actually got in line behind the zebra to the watering hole because they formed this single file line, kind of like horses coming back to the barn when they know it's dinner time. And the zebra had followed the single file line, and they were headed off to the water. And we were trying to go that same way, and our driver said, well, I guess we'll just get in line with the zebras. So we got in line, and then the zebras continued their line behind us. And so we were going about 3 miles an hour down this little path as one of the zebras, and it was very cool, and they didn't mind us at all at that point. But if we tried to drive up and get close to them at other places, they would just politely turn and walk away. But I did get some good pictures, yeah. So that was great. But the height of what I really wanted to see was the big lions, and I thought I'd had my fill from that first sighting in the morning. Well, it was hot in the afternoon, and again, I hear a lot of chatter on the radio. We don't see any cars anywhere else, any rovers, until there's some really cool sighting, and then a few of them will come out of the woodwork, and I don't know where they come from. They just appear. Well, a yibu's on the radio, and I hear Simba, Simba again, and I thought, oh, this is going to be great. Well, he speeds off, and he says, hang on, and we're driving down, kicking up dust everywhere on the path, and we drive up, and there are a ton of safari vehicles that have just appeared out of nowhere, and it turns out that one safari vehicle had driven up and seen a couple of big lions wandering around way out in the middle where there are no trees, and the lions have gotten really smart. The lions see the rover. Well, the rover cast a big shadow. And so what the lion had done, he'd walk over to the safari rover and laid down in the shadow. So
at your rover? Like at your feet?
Yes. When we drew him up, he was laying down at another rover's shadow, and our driver got all the way up there. And I've got this great video that I need to post online where I'm going, oh, my goodness, there's a lion right there. Because as soon as the rover pulled away, there was a lion laying right in the shade. And what had happened is he got really grumpy when his shade left. And so he got up and looked around in both directions and laid down in the next rover beside him because there were a few lined up. Well, we drove around, turned around, and came up the other way. And when we were right there in the other direction, the rovers that had been there for a while pulled away, and I'm filming the lion that I said, oh, gosh, he's leaving, and I'm filming him. And the rover in front of us pulled away, and there was a lion probably 10 feet from me, big, full mane around his neck, big mane lion, full belly. And I was filming one lion, and he was 10 feet away from me, and his shade had moved, and his neck shaved shade was right under our vehicle, and he looked me straight in the eye, and I thought, oh, this is a grumpy lion. This is not good. What's going to happen now? And so that's the point where I dropped my camera. I slammed the sliding window closed. I think I may have screamed. And then I thought, what kind of adventurer am I? But the lion walked all the way up to our safari vehicle. And our guide said, oh, we can't get stuck with a lion under our car. So at that point, we'd been there about 30 minutes. And so we drove off, and he went to the next car to lay down. But literally, the breath of the lion and the smell of the lion was right in front of my face. And it was a primal, visceral experience ever, because I didn't think he was going to eat me because he was pretty full. But I thought he might be really mad and just take a swipe. And he's going to get my camera and probably my arm, because I had my arm hanging out the window. And it was just smart lions. And that's what they do. They follow the shade of safari vehicles. So that's wow. How you get up close and personal with a lion. And that's the Ngorongoro crater is really key for being able to see that, because they've got the most large land mammals of any other area in the world, according to a couple of different sources, including our guide. And it really was true to form, because we were face-to-face with everything. And that lion, you know, I've got a picture of him laying underneath the Rover, snuggled up against the tire, taking a nap. So we just sat there and watched the big lion sleep.
Wow. Oh, wow. That's incredible. Well, between Kilimanjaro and face-to-face with lions and having jackals stalking your lunch, I mean, you've just crossed something off of your bucket list for sure. This trip is just amazing.
Well, I hope you enjoyed Kimberly and all of her adventures in climbing Mount Kilimanjaro and also her African trek. I know that I found that fascinating, and if you hadn't heard it before, sorry about the sound quality. Our sound in the beginning of the show when these episodes were taken was a little worse than it is now. They've improved that quite a bit with the service we're using, so we're hoping you find it better nowadays than you did way back when. And next up, we have Max Johnson, who was from the Grand Canyon Mule Rides. Talks all about the rides and the adventures that they've had with the mules in the canyon. And it was a fun interview. We really enjoyed talking to him, and Jamie especially. She lives right down the road from there. So here it is. This is Max Johnson from the Grand Canyon Mule Rides. This was episode number 193 from July the 27th.
Well, I would like to welcome Max to the show today, because we've been talking a little bit about it, and one of my good friends is a veterinarian for the Grand Canyon Mules. And when I texted her one day, I'm like, hey, what'd you do today? She's like, I floated 23 mules' teeth. I was like, oh, you have to tell me that story. So I found out that she's been running up there and doing the vet work for the Grand Canyon Mules, and I am a former... I'm a former rider. I completed the entire Grand Canyon all-day mule ride down at the bottom of the canyon back up. So we'd like to say hello to Max Johnson. First of all, good morning, Max.
Good morning. How are you?
We're doing fantastic. We're doing fantastic. So tell us, first of all, what do you do for the, is it the Grand Canyon Mule Rides? Is that what it's called?
Yes, ma'am. It's a... the rides here on the South Rim for Zanterra Corporation, and I'm the manager of the Mule Livery Barn.
The manager of the Mule Livery Barn. So you should be able to tell us maybe a little bit of the history of, because I think it's got a lot of history with the Grand Canyon itself tied into the mule. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, in my opinion, the mules are the Grand Canyon. People come to, when they come to visit here, there's two things most of them see. They walk over and look at that big hole in the ground, and then they come to the mule. The mules are the history here. They've been here for over 100 years, and I pray to God they'll be here for another 100 years.
So is, I know you guys have been there. I had no idea it was 100 years. That's absolutely fantastic. So in 100 years, there's got to be some pretty good stories that you have to tell. We'll get to those, but I want to ask first, why mules?
Well, in my opinion, mules are more trustworthy than horses. They're into self-preservation. When you get a good mule, he is not going to do anything to hurt himself. Horses, they can get tend to be a bit more skittish. We can afford horses, and if they were better, we'd use them, but they're not. Mules can take to the altitude better. You know, they're in and out every day. We're at 7,000-foot elevation up here on top. By the time they get to Phantom Ranch in about 4.5 hours, it's down to 2,000 foot, you know, and it's a great drop in altitude, and then coming up is the same way. Mules do this. They can do it every day. I don't know that horses would stand up. Mules are more sturdy for this type of job.
I agree, and it's funny because it doesn't matter what job you're doing. If you ask a question of a mule person, you know they're a mule person because they will immediately tell you why they're better than horses. My next door neighbor is a mule person, and I get it all the time.
Yeah.
So, Meg, paint a picture for us of what a ride would be like for somebody coming, a tourist coming to the Grand Canyon. What is it like? What are they going to do? What are they going to see?
Well, if they're going to take the Phantom Ranch ride, they'll go to the rim. They'll meet us at the Round Corral at 7 o'clock in the morning. Be scared to death, of course, when they look off the edge, because a lot of folks are scared of heights. I mean, common sense tells you it's steep. You don't want to go there. And then, of course, they're full of questions about the mules. Have you ever lost one? Have we, you know, all the different questions. And the answer is we've never lost a guest. We always find them. No, I'm just kidding.
That's pretty good.
That's good.
And a little more on that subject there. I don't know how to run a computer very good, but I've been told you can get on there and Google anything. So I want anybody here listening today or get on there and Google it, and you will see there has never, ever been a fatal accident off the back of a mule in the Grand Canyon. Now, that's pretty good odds over the years.
100 years.
A lot of people with broken backs and quadriplegics, or is it? I noticed how you said fatal accident.
No fatal accident. Nobody's ever died riding a mule in the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
That's pretty good odds right there.
That's pretty good if you've been doing it for 100 years. That's pretty good.
I myself have been mules.
You know, I got to ask you, though. There's got to be those people that come up to the counter. You go, I'm really worried about this one.
Oh, yeah, every day.
But, I assume you do not want them drunk at 7 o'clock in the morning. That probably eliminates you from the mule ride, doesn't it?
Oh, that will adios you the quickest. Yes, sir, it will.
Yeah. Have you had that at 7 o'clock in the morning?
No, sir. I don't believe we've ever had any trouble with people drinking going down. They probably wished they had after they got going, but no, they that I suppose.
Now, Jamie, you were at the edge there. You looked down. You're a horse person. Did you think the same thing, that this is stupid? Why am I doing this?
No, I'm a horse person, but...
You're asking the horse person. Go ahead, Mags. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought he was talking to me.
No, actually, I was asking Jamie because I know she's done that, and I wanted her, you know, and she is a horse person. Did you have that feeling as a horse person that you were going, this is nuts, why am I doing this?
You know what? It's funny. When I went to the corral at 7 o'clock in the morning and they started assigning you mules, they gave me, and I mean, granted, I'm like, you know, almost 5'3", but they gave me the tiniest little, I felt like I was riding a mini mule. This thing was so tiny. I'm like, there is no way this sucker's going to carry me down and back. And I can't say that I was scared looking over and starting down, but there's a place that they call me, and I don't know if they still call it this. I did this ride 10 years ago. I think they called it John Wayne Bend. Do you know what I'm talking about, Max?
Yes, ma'am, I do. It's still there.
I know it's still there. I'm sure that I didn't know if they called it the same thing. So John Wayne Bend is where apparently... Tell a story of what that is, Max.
Well, it's a switchback. It's at the top of what we call the Devil's Corkscrew, and that kind of is self-explanatory right there. You're going to the left, you switch back underneath yourself back to the right. You could reach up and touch the mule's foot above you as you go back.
Ah!
Yeah, it'll make you, that's for sure.
And that, Mike, that, Glenn, was the moment that I said to myself, why am I doing this? But is it, Max, is it true that it's because that's where John Wayne lost his hat?
Yeah, that's the story, I believe. I have heard that story. I don't know if that's true, but I haven't asked John. I haven't seen him since, you know, many years. But
now, well, I got to ask you, Max, are there, and I have not taken this ride yet, are there guides on each one of, in other words, is the first person the guide, or are they on their own? The mules just know the way.
No, there's a guide that goes down. When we go to Phantom Ranch, there's a guide in the front and a guide in the back for each group, and we can take up to 10 people to Phantom Ranch each day.
And the Phantom Ranch one, now, is that an overnight one, or is that just down and back up?
No, that Phantom Ranch is it's an overnight. You go down and stay all night. You're down there 12:30, 12:45, you know, and then you get off and monkey around down there at the ranch, stay all night. And the folks that haven't been to Phantom Ranch, they've told me that is there buildings down there, you know, is there, what do you sleep in, tents, what do you sleep? And I said, no, it's darn sure there's cabins, there's a lodge. Dinner and breakfast is served family style. It's got electricity. You've got a payphone down there. Air conditioning, swamp coolers, whatever there is. You can even hook your laptop up down there if you need to. So it's and it's on the north side of the river. We go down the Bright Angel Trail and go through the tunnel. And once you come out of the tunnel, you're on the swinging bridge. It's 440 foot long, 5 foot high, and it's on cables. And you go right on across to Phantom Ranch and spend the night and come out the next day up the South Kaibab Trail.
There's internet at the bottom of the Grand Canyon.
Well, you know, you can get it if you got if you stand in the right place with one arm up and the leg bent, I believe you could get
it. With a piece of tinfoil on your toe.
That'd work.
Funny.
Now, I got to ask you, Jamie, and I want Max to this too. Did you find it scarier going down or back up?
Well, it's...
Go ahead, Max, first. What do people find it?
Well, it's six of one and a half dozen the other with the guests. Well, it's hard to say.
Jamie, what about you?
You know what? I think that I was super excited going down. And it was nerve-wracking because what Max is avoiding telling you is you are on a tiny trail, and there is a sheer drop off to your left, and to your right is a sheer wall, so really not much room for error. But these mules are so sure-footed and tough, and they know their job so well that it wasn't that scary. What was really kind of bothered me was by the time I got down to the bottom, I was so dang tired and sore. The prospect of getting on and going back up was exhausting. So I can't say which one I liked more, but I am glad I did it. I'm glad I did the whole experience of the whole thing. But
well, I was just going to say, you told us on that note, and this will be interesting for Max to comment on too. You told us last week that the people who seem to be more tired when they get done with this are horse people, because they're not relaxed. They're always trying to ride the mule as opposed to just sitting there. Is you know, you told us that last week, didn't you, Jamie, that the people on the trip? Yeah.
We did the day ride, and by the time I got off, I was riding 7-8 horses a day in my life at that point. And I got off, and I was so tired, and I see these people who've never sat on an animal in their life get off, and they're like, okay, where are we going to go now? And I was exhausted and in pain, and I said to my guide, I'm like, how come they're so spry and I'm exhausted? And he said, because you rode like you knew what was going to happen. Now, of course, he wouldn't tell me what could happen after the ride, but I'm curious to know, Max, have you seen that? Is that the case normally?
Yeah, the horse people, it's like you just said, you know, they're trying to, they sit up there and ride because they know the possibilities of what the animal can do. And to be downright honest, they don't really trust a mule because a lot of times this is the first time they've been on one, and they're thinking stubborn and all that kind of stuff, when the mules really aren't stubborn. They just they know their job, and the folks that really have no experience riding at all, yeah, they're sore, but they take in the whole thing to where the horse people are trying to figure out what the mule's going to do next, and you might as well give it up because you ain't going to figure it out.
Now,
and, you know, I think what's happening is the horse people are actually sitting there thinking that they're still relating it to riding their wacko thoroughbred. And they know what their wacko thoroughbred would do around Devil's Turn or Devil's Bend or whatever that was. He'd be over the edge. So I can see why horse people would have a little trouble with that.
Yeah, that's the answer right there, sir.
Now, I got to ask, Max, do you select these mules, hand train them? How does the mule selection process work? Because you're taking on a big risk by throwing some, you know, beginners up on a mule and having them ride down switchbacks.
Yes, we buy our mules, and we try to buy them what we call dude broke. Some of them are, some of them aren't. Even though we buy them ready for the tourist, the guides themselves and the packers and the rest of us will ride these mules all the time on top. We'll go down to get them legged up and to where they get to breathe and bear. We'll take them a mile and a half house and back up, wait a couple days, go back down to 2 mile, blah, blah, and just to build up their stamina and to see how the mules are. Now, there are some mules that are scared to death of heights. And you find that out pretty quick. But we never put the guests on them until we're satisfied that mule, all he does is get in line and puts his head down and follows the guy in front of him. And we can't take a chance of getting a tourist hurt. So we ride him for many. I mean, we might ride him for 2 or 3 years if need be.
Wow.
And if they're really ornery or something like that, we might send them and they'll pack. We'll use them for pack mules, which we pack all the supplies to Phantom Ranch, all the food and beverages and all that kind of stuff goes to Phantom Ranch, and the mules might be doing that for a while if they're going to act up and be a little ornery.
You know, the ones that are scared to death of heights, they do a check. The first test they do is they walk them up to the edge, and if they turn around and bolt to Phoenix, they know that that one ain't so good.
That's a good idea, but we usually get on them and ride them down, and they bolt to Phoenix from there. So.
So do they pack all the supplies down to Phantom Ranch?
Yes, sir. Yeah, we've got three guys that hired full-time that do nothing but pack all the supplies down. Yep, all the bed linens. And if it fits on the mule and goes through the tunnel, we take it down on mules. If it does not, if it's something bigger that has to be done down there at Phantom, then they'll have to sling it down with a helicopter.
Now, do you, I assume that the people you hire, what kind of people do you look for? This is you know, we always talk about the jobs. So we have teenagers always coming up and saying, what kind of jobs can you get in the horse world? This is one that we have never recommended yet. What do you look for in the guide?
Well, we look for somebody with livestock experience is a plus. They can learn that. We hope that they have some of it by the time they get here. And then somebody that's worked with people, not necessarily office jobs, but somebody that's good with people, can BS people and can learn. We do not just hire somebody over the phone. If somebody's interested, they send in their resume, and human resources will check out their resumes. They say, give me the okay. And then I'll ask, you know, tell the person, we're not going to hire you. You have to come in here and take a student ride, which they will have to go to Phantom Ranch, and they will have to come out. They don't have to pay for it on the student ride. We take care of that, but we want to make sure they can take the height and the depth and the trail and the heat and all that kind of stuff. And then if they come out, then we'll talk from there if it's a good possibility they can work here. Some people can't do it. We've had people come out for a student ride that they're scared to death. They couldn't do it. So that's why we don't hire over the phone. They have to come out, and I want to look them in the eye. I want to talk to them.
And he wants to see if they're throwing up when they're looking over the side. That's the other thing.
Well, That's a cue that they probably aren't going
to
work out.
If they turn and bolt to Phoenix, not hiring them. They're going to be out there with that mule someplace in the desert.
No, they ain't gonna, they can run, but they better leave my mules here.
I think it's funny to say if they come out. Have you ever had anybody not come out that was applying for a job?
No, if they went as far as to send in their resume, and I explained to them that it is steep, it's hot, it's cold in the winter, of course, here at 7,000 foot. It's trails can be ice for a mile and a half to 2 miles down in the wintertime. Now, that'll slow down a lot of folks from coming out to do a student ride.
Well, I got to say, I saw pictures of the horses with snow on the ground. So you still do, or the mules, rather, you still do this trip in the winter?
Year-round, 365 days a year.
Do you put Boreum? Do they have shoes? First of all, do they have shoes on all four, and do you put Boreum on then in the winter, or what do you do?
Well, Boreum, you know, it's like wearing a tennis shoe, as far as I'm concerned. In the summertime, they have regular shoes. In the wintertime, their shoes are treated with tungsten carbide chips, which is big around as your little finger, and the shoer, he'll put that on there with the forge, has to be melted on. They can walk across concrete, asphalt, snow, ice. They'll cut grooves in the asphalt walking on it to help with the slipping problems.
Good Lord. Now, see, Glenn Boreum sounds old school compared to tungsten carbide chips. My God, that's awesome. I had no idea, but see, I bet the tourism slows down because my father came to visit me at Christmas. And he wanted to drive up to the Grand Canyon, but the road was closed because of all the snow. So do you have to shut down sometimes, or do people come from other parts?
We will shut down in the winter maybe one day or two, only if it's unsafe, like if we'll get a snow. In the canyon when it snows, it might be raining at Phantom Ranch, but it's snowing here at 7,000 foot. And as it snows down off the rim a ways, of course, that wind blows up. You walk to the edge, it'll blow your hat off. You know what I mean? The snow comes up, and it drifts the trails over. So we might have to cancel the ride that day, but we still have to go down and scoop that trail out for maybe 100 yards, maybe a mile, maybe a mile and a half. We have to scoop it out because we'll always have people coming out of Phantom from the ride the day before.
No,
snowblowers.
Oh,
I didn't think about
there.
The people getting stuck down there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have to scoop, and of course we scoop the Bright Angel Trail and the South Kaibab also, because they come up the South Kaibab Trail from Phantom. You go down the Bright Angel, come up South Kaibab.
Okay, so we're unfortunately running out of time. Where can people find, because there's more rides than just one. There's a ton of them, and you guys put it on your bucket list. Make sure that you go. Glenn, you've got to be tough enough to do this ride. I've done it. Nobody's ever died. You heard, dang, I'm going to knock on wood right now after I said nobody's ever died doing the ride. But just go ahead and go do it. What is the website, Max, that people can find out a little bit more about you guys?
I believe it's Zantara.com. That's the website for the company, and I'm sure it has a list of what all, you know, you can look at or all those kind of things there. I think people will come, when they come, they'll be surprised at our mules. A lot of folks don't realize these mules are on full feed 365 days a year. They're on a shoeing schedule 6 to 8 weeks, or if they need it earlier, they get it. Our mules are on a regular rotation, which means that everybody gets so many days off a week. We've started a therapy session with an equine therapist from Tucson. Rene Noriega comes up, and he'll adjust and work with our mules. He's been here twice since February to assess our mules and to fix them. We got a veterinarian on full time, 24/7, and you know her. That'd be Misa Dickinson. Our mules are athletes, and that's what we treat them like. You know, if they need something, we try to get it for them. They make our money for us. As far as I'm concerned, their little hoof print ought to be on the bottom right-hand corner of my check, because that's who we're working.
I love it. Well, I certainly think you guys do a great job. How many mules are there total?
Right now we only have 141, but mules are like knives and guns. A guy can never have too many of any.
Mules are like knives and guns. I love it.
That's going to be a quote we're going to use again.
Yeah, save that. Well, listen, Max, thank you so much for being on the show. We wish you the best of luck. And I will be up at the Grand Canyon come, I think, September, something like that. So I'll come and find you and say hey.
You're more than welcome to. And thank you, folks, for having us. I appreciate it. Come see our mule.
And that was Max Johnson. That was a fun interview all about the Grand Canyon mule rides. And, of course, Jamie had done that. I have not yet, but I think that's on the list of things that we must accomplish. Don't forget that we're very excited that we're going to have a visit to Norco, California. They've invited us to come out, and they're putting out the red carpet for us to come out at the end of November, beginning of December. We'll have three special shows live from Norco, and we'll be telling you all about our adventures there. It looks like they have a jam-packed full for us while we're there in Norco, and we really appreciate all of their efforts to bring us out there. It is greatly appreciated. If you have an event that you would like us to attend, just get in contact with us. Drop me an email at glenn@horseradionetwork.com. Well, Jamie, Jennifer, and I will be back on Monday after our vacation, and you can look for us at 9 a.m. Eastern Live. We have a whole bunch of great shows for the rest of this week, though, so tune in every morning. We have some new ones for you, as well as some best of shows. So we hope you enjoyed this, and we'll be talking to you again tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Well, spay, neuter, and geld, as Jamie would say, and wear your helmet, as I would say, and see you at Peelers.